this afternoon. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. Merivale Pharmaceuticals Incorporated versus Ernest Havner and Marilyn Havner on behalf of their minor child from Nueces County. Arthur Anderson and Company versus Perry Equipment Corporation from Harris County. Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company versus Nisika Limited and others from Jefferson County. And Gulf States Utilities Company versus the Public Utility Commission of Texas and others from Travis County. In the first cause, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The other three causes, we have allotted 20 minutes for each side. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and we will have a lunch recess before the final argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of argument time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. The court is making an oral tape of these arguments, and you may purchase a copy of that tape with the clerk of our court by making application with the clerk. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Merivale Pharmaceuticals Incorporated versus Ernest and Marilyn Havner.
Okay, please the court. Mr. John Hill, Jr. will present arguments for the petitioner. Petitioner should reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice and Mayor. Please the court. First, with your kind permission, I'd like to address our point of error that there is legally insufficient, reliable, scientific expert evidence to support a jury verdict for plaintiffs in this case. We deal here this morning with what this court in DuPont versus Robinson, in referring to this case, has denominated a novel scientific question. Whether plaintiff presented reliable scientific evidence that ingestion of the drug Vindectin made and marketed by Merrill for use by a pregnant mother for morning sickness in prescribed therapeutic dosage causes limb reduction birth defects. And specifically, as applied to this case, was there reliable scientific evidence that Vindectin caused Kelly Havner to be born with fingers missing from her right hand? That very scientific question was faced in our federal Fifth Circuit in Brock versus Merrill Dow in 1989, and cited and discussed in our brief. The Brock court held, as you know, that in view of the massive, overwhelming, worldwide, human, scientific, published, peer-reviewed, epidemiology studies that had concluded uniformly that there was no statistical significant relationship between Vindectin and limb reduction birth defects, that a jury verdict to the contrary could not stand. Yes, Your Honor.
I realize that the comment you're making now and an argument that you rely upon heavily in your briefing is that we have a lot of cases, almost all of the cases, have come down in favor of Dow and against the plaintiff. My question is it not true that the factual development of this case is different from those other cases, and that there may be more evidence presented at the trial of this case than in those other cases, so we can't really compare apples to apples with those other cases?
Not at all, at police court. The case at bar is exactly the same evidentiary case, for example, as that one. Same expert, exact same evidence. There's really, essentially, no difference in the record in any of these cases. This is the only state court case in Texas in which an attempt is being made to obtain a different result based upon the same evidence.
Is there any other case that you know of, Mr. Hill, where one of the experts testified that the relevant risk of exposure to Vindectin during the first trimester was in excess of 2?
No.
And so this, Court of Appeals at page 555 said that Dr. Glasser in this case did testify to that. Do you dispute that? Or
I do dispute that, yes, Your Honor. Dr. Glasser's testimony is exactly the same as in Daubert. It was just put in affidavit form since that was a summary judgment case. There is no difference in this case. No essential difference in this case than the Daubert record. There's no difference in this case than the other decided cases holding that the epidemiological studies, being so massive and so overwhelming, were to be given great weight and could not be overthrown by this sort of reanalysis that I will discuss.
Given our
They're in the record, may it please the court. They're part of the evidence in this case shows this pattern has been studied not only in this country but throughout the world. It's been studied in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in Australia, in Germany, in Spain. There's never been a drug, certainly not one dealing with the needs of pregnant women, that have been so steady as this one, and totally exonerated by all of these studies worldwide over a long extended period of time.
But under our no evidence standard of review, can you explain to me how it is that we take those into account in looking at the no evidence?
What you first, of course, must look at is plaintiff's proof. And I want to try to discuss that as I go along here. This is part of the entire record. But I recognize that the plaintiff has the burden to prove, in this case, from reliable scientific evidence, that there's a basis for Dr. Palmer's testimony that Vindectin caused Kelly Havner's birth defect. Yes, they have that burden. You must find that there's some reliable scientific evidence to support that opinion, or else there is no care here. The consideration of the other studies is just part of the task that the courts have carried forward in looking at Vindectin and criticizing the methodology that's used by Dr. Palmer in trying to get around those studies. So, since Brock, there are four other federal circuit court cases involving the claims that Vindectin caused limb reduction defects, all, as we know, been relied favorably to Merrill Dow, either on the grounds that the scientific expert evidence brought forward by plaintiff was both inadmissible and legally insufficient. And those are cases that are cited and discussed in our brief that I'm sure the court will take into account. The United States government speaking through the FDA, and I'm referring to record evidence in this case, has concluded as far back as 1983, no further studies concerning this matter are justified. And it's been decided in one of the most studied drugs in history, and it's been scientifically exonerated from the charge that it causes limb reduction birth defects. Quote, we do not believe available information supports the conclusion that Vindectin is teratogenic in humans. And later in 1987, quote, the agency has again reviewed extensive data and concludes that it is unlikely that Vindectin is a teratogen.
Okay, what about the Havner's argument, though, that in 1987 it was on the government's list of developmental toxins?
Well, a developmental toxin, there was one test. It was a test with very, very high dosage, hundreds of times more than the human dosage, that resulted in the basis of them saying that it was a toxicant. That's a far cry, Your Honor, from saying that it is the cause of limb reduction defects. that's the kind of thing that this plaintiffs have done in these cases all over this country, is just picked at little matters, little points, which are just, they don't prove their case. They're just a point.
So you're saying there's a meaningful distinction between a toxicant and a teratogen?
Oh, yes, definitely. Scientifically, not the same.
What would you require, and what would you say that we should require as a foundation for the admissibility and sufficiency of expert testimony in a case like this?
Well,
epidemiological studies and the like, could you sort of expand on that one?
Interestingly enough, in answering that, Your Honor, I don't have to enter the war between you and Justice Gonzales.
This is
a novel which you recognize, Your Honor, in your writings in DuPont versus Robinson. You recognize the vindictive cases as being something you felt comfortable with as the result that was being reached.
Well, my question, though, has to do more generally with, if we're going to say that we will not accept as any evidence the opinion of an expert who draws inferences from some sort of scientific foundation, I'm wondering what kind of foundation would, in your opinion, be adequate to allow that testimony to be admissible and to uphold the judgment?
Well, certainly a lot different than what Dr. Palmer had in this case.
Yeah.
And Dr. Palmer's evidence in this case is what's being judged. It's the only evidence that they have in this record.
We're going to write a standard that's going to apply to a lot of different cases other than this particular one. And what I would like to know is, are you saying that there must be at least some epidemiological studies that show that the relative risk of exposure is in excess of a particular figure?
I think the epidemiology studies have been pointed out by the Supreme Court of the United States and all these other courts. Is entitled to its weight, entitled to major league consideration, or heavy consideration. Brock went so far as to say in the Fifth Circuit that it would in effect just have privacy action, something that could be shown to knock it down, which they haven't. They continue to go along with the same little circle of criticism of our studies and unscientific approaching to this question, which they never put to scientific review or peer review, never change a thing, and expect, I guess, to find a soft spot in Texas court, a system in the state court. And maybe it'll ride here. It hasn't ridden anywhere else. And Dr. Palmer's evidence, I hate to keep... Let me see what Judge Sheridan said. Could you imagine what a surprise it was to us when his unanimous panel opinion was thrown out in this case by the newly elected court. He said, except for serving as an expert witness in other vindictive litigation, Dr. Palmer has never studied nor diagnosed the cause of the human birth defect. He was unaware and unconcerned with the dosage, timing, or number of vindictin tablets ingested by Mrs. Havner. He based his opinion on the same in vitro animal studies and chemical analogy studies utilized by the other experts called by the Havners and finding of even general causation. And reliance on these studies amounts to nothing more than pure speculation. He relied on drug experience reports filed by lawyers and doctors and other individuals, which he admitted were voluntary and unsubstantiated, that they lack scientific methodology and controls, and that they did not suggest causation. However, on this tenuous basis, despite the admitted fact that no scientist who had actually researched the relationship between vindictin and birth defect has concluded there is a causal relationship, Dr. Palmer opines specific causation in this case. His opinion is wholly without any foundation or underlying scientific support, and in essence, no more than lay opinion and surmise disguised as scientific dogma. So I'm suggesting, Your Honor, I don't know how you arrive at the case. It's clearly a no-evidence case. it's clearly a case where there is no reliable scientific evidence to support causation of a limb reduction defect in this case.
If there was evidence, if there was evidence that the relative risk of limb reduction defects arising under the epidemiological data exceeded 2, would that be sufficient for Dr. Palmer or any other expert witness to opine as to causation?
He didn't rely on any such thing.
Mr. Hill, I'm asking you if he had. I'm asking you, you say that didn't happen. I'm asking a hypothetical then, I guess. If it had, would that be sufficient?
I don't know on what scientific evidence any such statement could be made. There is no such evidence.
I'm asking you to assume that there is. This is a hypothetical question. If there was, would that be sufficient?
If there were human studies, at least we'd have a starting point. The problem with this case, number one, is they don't have any studies of their own. They have never done any independent research into this at all. This is all courthouse testimony that is data dredged from studies that others have made. And all of those studies that others have made say that bendactin does not cause birth defect generally, and certainly specifically does not cause limb reduction.
But our problem here, we're not going to conduct any human study to determine whether or not this drug causes a limb defect. All we can go on are animal studies, drug experience reports, and epidemiological studies.
Well, in all due respect, you know, the epidemiological studies are human studies. And of course, the most massive one that's ever been conducted is the fact that since 1983, bendactin has not been distributed in this country, and there's no difference in birth defects, certainly not in limb reduction defects.
Isn't it true that none of those studies make any conclusions with regard to the issue of causation?
Oh, yes. They all say there is no statistical relationship between the ingestion of bendactin by mothers for morning sickness and in limb reduction defects. None whatsoever. They all conclude exactly opposite from what Dr. Palmer is trying to harm all parents.
Mr. Hill?
In the courtroom. It's totally opposite.
Going back to Justice Owen's question, the standard of review of no evidence is to look at only the evidence the plaintiff puts on to see if it rises to a scintilla. And you commented just a few minutes ago that this is a no evidence case. So would you agree that we don't look at the studies that you talk about from other countries that say there's no connection, but we have to look only at what the plaintiff proffered? And do I understand your point is that the record shows that Dr. Palmer is the only expert offered by the plaintiff who testified about causation in this case under these facts?
And
your point is that in this case, his testimony is no evidence.
Exactly. It's not reliable science. And it's the same evidence, as I pointed out, that was in Daubert, which y'all wrote extensively on in DuPont versus Robinson, that very case, stating let me quote it. Dr. Palmer does not testify on the basis discussing that very matter, on the basis of the collective view of his scientific discipline, nor does he take issue with his peers and explain the grounds for his differences. Indeed, no understandable scientific basis is stated. Personal opinion, not science, is testifying here. Taken in the light, as the Daubert Court said, taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the scientific evidence that provides the foundation for the expert opinion on causation is not sufficient to support a causation finding. And then, Justice Gonzalez, when you alluded to that in Robinson, you said the only review the plaintiff's expert work has received has been by judges and juries, and the only place their theories and studies have been submitted is in the pages of federal and state law reporters. There was no review or publication of their research. Their testimony was inadmissible under Rule 702 because it was not based on reliable methodology and not relevant to the task at hand. Now, there's no indication that that part of Robinson is or should be controversial. It's still what you have yourself alluded to. It's exactly why the Ninth Circuit, when they had the case sent back to them by the United States Supreme Court under the Daubert factors, threw it out, said it was insufficient, not only inadmissible, but insufficient. This
Judge,
very Judge, evidence that Judge they have
Kuczynski,
reviewed.
Judge Kuczynski on remand from the United States Supreme Court noted that none of the plaintiff's epidemiology experts in Daubert claimed that the relevant risk factor was greater than 2. My question that I asked earlier, which I don't think you've gotten around to answering yet, is if it had been greater than 2, would that be sufficient to support an expert's opinion that there was causation?
I don't think I should be prepared, and Your Honor, to answer you directly this morning on that. I'm not trying to be difficult, or I certainly don't want to offend you of all people, but I don't think so. I don't know of any evidence that it's as much as 2. Many of the courts have said it ought to be as much as 2. That has been a factor that they've used from time to time in analyzing whether this case ought to be allowed to withstand an insufficiency. But whether I'm prepared to say today that given a case, and I don't think you're going to see one, but given a case where there's some sort of epidemiological study that may that goes as high as a factor of 2, we just have to cross that bridge when we get to it. We don't have it here, and we don't have anything near to it here.
Any other
questions? I reserve
the
balance of my time. One more question. What do you think is the best way for trial courts to implement the plot procedure? Is that something that should be done before trial begins, a week or a month before trial, or is it something that should be done when the party calls the expert witness to the stand and you go through a determination about whether the expert qualifies and then they're either excluded or excluded at that time?
Who am I to say? I'm not sitting up there trying to, you're the ones to write and decide those kind of issues. You're the one guiding it. Maybe I would say it's a preliminary pre-trial matter. I never have thought of it any other way. And to have a hearing, have a 104 type hearing, and see everybody show and tell, see what they've got. And let the judge make a judgment as to whether or not he thinks it's adequate to withstand summary judgment or to withstand the sufficiency review or whether it's reliable scientific evidence. They've got their work cut out for them, and that's what they'll have to do. I happen to believe one of those that believe they're perfectly capable of doing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Thank you, please, the court. Mr. Robert Hilliard and Mr. Barry Nace will hear argument from respondents. Mr. Hilliard will open with the first 15 minutes.
Good morning. For the court's permission, Kelly Havner is the first girl on the left, and I promise not to introduce her to y'all because she wants to be one of us. I'm here today to talk about a few things on this case with you. The first is that even under Robinson, this record is sufficient to sustain this Corpus Christi verdict. And also to talk some about what Justice Abbott just mentioned, and that is the practicality of how this is going to happen if Robinson isn't reanalyzed.
Reanalyzed or overruled?
I don't think we can have one without the other.
Obviously, there's been some questioning about this relative risk factor to Dr. Palmer's conclusion that there's a relative risk factor of 2, is it based on a reanalysis of the epidemiological studies, or does he have some sort of independent basis for concluding there's a relative risk factor?
Is that Dr. Palmer or Dr. Glasser?
Dr. Glasser, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's on a reanalysis of the epidemiological data.
If reanalysis is the essential element, essentially, an essential element of what the difference in the facts in this case as opposed to what the Ninth Circuit saw or whatever the Fifth Circuit saw, would it be critical whether or not these doctors had published their conclusions and subjected them to peer review so the scientific community could really establish whether or not their reanalysis was valid? I mean, what they've done is they've taken a study that says it's not a relative risk factor two. They said, well, we look at it and we decided it is a relative risk. Wouldn't it be critical to your position that these doctors were willing to put their conclusions to a peer review test?
No, and I'll tell you why. There is a amicus curiae brief by some epidemiologist, the editor of the Epidemiology Journal, who speaks to this issue, to peer review, whether peer review is the end all. And what that amicus says, and it's in front of this court, is that peer review is not where the inquiry ends. And they specifically say, we're not here to decide if the plaintiffs in vindictive cases win or the defendants in vindictive cases win. We're here to explain to the Ninth Circuit, and that's why it's filed, that they misconstrue reanalysis and they misconstrue peer review. As practicing epidemiologists, they say the critical information is the exact information that Havner experts rely on. That's just not the epidemiology, but it's also the animal studies. It's also looking at how this antihistamine...
But the question is, but if the studies they rely on in coming to their conclusion come to a different conclusion, how can the courts give any possible resolution of that dispute without the scientific community at first having an opportunity to review that methodology? It seemed to be the whole point of the peer review was to decide if these studies are conducted according to scientific principles. It's not to evaluate the conclusions. What we have here is we have studies that were subjected to scientific methodology and review and study. And it seems to me the conclusions were never brought in doubt. What's now brought in doubt is as this particular doctor looks at them and I say, well, I decided that's wrong. But how can the jury of 12, or how can this court, or how can any lay person who's not immersed in scientific analysis and studies be able to evaluate yes or no? Why shouldn't we, as gatekeepers, require this new conclusion be set before the scientific community and let them decide that this reanalysis is a valid enterprise that's being conducted?
There is no reason why we shouldn't. However, that should not be the key to the gate. If that is now the key to this gate that the trial judge has to determine, then what we may have, to use your example, are well-respected scientists, as the Ninth Circuit conceded in the U.S. Supreme Court, testifying squarely within matters that involve their expertise, that have a methodology that the testimony on this record says is the methodology that scientists use in trying to determine if a drug can cross the placenta and cause abortion.
Let me ask you this on that point. One of the points it seems to me you make is that we don't want to test this on humans. But the fact is, don't you have a tremendous history of actual human usage that you can make some determination?
Sure.
And why does that human study demonstrate a risk factor of 2, according to the scientific community?
Glatzer says that taken during the first trimester, it does. The statistical risk factor of the epidemiological studies came out on the stand for a long time. That was one of the issues that kept coming up. I lost your question.
Well, the point being, isn't the most reliable information available is the actual experience of human beings ingesting Benedictine over a long period of time? Isn't that really the key to this case?
Yes. The raw data is some of the best evidence. And what the record in this case showed was that we took the raw data, just like our own federal government does before they say to Merrill Dow, we will approve your drug, or before they say to a pesticide company, you can sell this pesticide. The federal government looks not at the conclusions, but at the raw data. And they look at that raw data, and they decide for themselves what the raw data means. So what that means to this case is that we checked those epidemiology studies. And by the way, there was, on the record, only 5 studies that had to deal with limb reduction defects in this case. And they all showed that there was an association between the victim and limb reduction defect.
Well, that's not the study you called it.
That's right. You can't prove Vindictin causes birth defects through epidemiological studies.
Did the FDA have studies before? Did they have the same raw data before?
The FDA approved this in, I think the record is like 40 days or so, and at that time, the general thinking was that this is a safe drug for humans.
Did it have the raw data?
I don't know.
But doesn't it become more critical on the peer review when you actually have human experience with the drug, numbers of humans over numbers of years, and studies of the raw data? Isn't it more critical when a conclusion is reached based on that raw data that that conclusion be subjected to peer review? The first conclusion was, wouldn't it be critical to admissibility of this evidence that the opposite conclusion based on the same raw data also be subjected to that same sort of review?
Before we were allowed to present it to a jury?
As part of the gatekeeping function on the reliability of that conclusion?
No, I disagree with that idea because I do believe, having said through this trial, that the methodologies that our experts used were sound and that they were subject to the cross-examination, as the U.S. Supreme Court says, of the other side in the adversarial process. Your suggestion is that you can't get to a jury unless you had peer-reviewed epidemiological studies showing an association. What that would do is, for example, the thalidomide cases, you remember those from the 60s, there was no epidemiological evidence to show there was a causation or an association.
No, that's not your response is broader than my question. When the original studies, long experience with human ingestion of the drug leads, and peer review leads to one conclusion, the conclusion being peer review, wouldn't it be appropriate in the gatekeeping function for a new conclusion based on a reanalysis of peer review that new conclusion be subjected to peer review if be allowed in? That's my narrow question.
Okay. And I've been wrestling with how a judge would do that on that issue. If you had a judge who was faced with that, if a narrow doubt stands up and says, Judge, we would like to show that we are the only ones with peer-reviewed evidence, the plaintiffs aren't, then he, Mr. Robinson, will have a hearing on that, and we'll hear whether or not there is peer-reviewed evidence to support it. The short answer to your question is that judge then has to weigh the credibility of the testimony presented by that peer-reviewed scientist. And I assume that as a trial lawyer, I get a chance to cross-examine him and find out who funded some of the peer-reviewed studies. And then the judge has to give weight to that testimony. If what you suggest is what this court is considering, then we have a trial judge who is now determining both the weight and the credibility of the witness as a gatekeeper function. And respectfully, I just believe that cannot be the law in Texas. That is unconstitutional under the Seventh Amendment, in my view.
Isn't that one of your problems, okay, applying the Daubert standards, that your experts have never concluded outside of the litigation context that there is a causal relationship between the drug and the birth defect? In other words, as an example,
yes,
Dr. Palmer has written over 30 pharmacology articles, and not in a single one of those pharmacology articles did he say that there was a causal connection here, which if he thought there was, he should have put it in there because there is a significance for science. But yet, he is able to conclude in a courtroom when he's being paid that there is a causal connection. Isn't that a significant hurdle that you have not yet overcome?
I think it is a significant hurdle to meeting our burden of proof. I do not believe that it is a hurdle that we should be forced to jump over before we can present evidence to a jury. It comes down, in my mind, to whether or not a judge is better, one man is better than 12 people, to decide if a paid expert who's never given his opinion before but in this courtroom is someone we're going to believe. And I honestly feel that the wiser and safer place for that determination has to be in the jury box.
So then you don't think that it matters when dealing with complex scientific concepts that it simply doesn't matter if a party's experts are offering conclusions to the jury, which has never been offered to the scientific community?
Yes, it does matter. I don't mean to suggest that it doesn't.
In this case, your experts have never offered to the scientific community the conclusions that they offered to the corpus of the jury.
That's right, but it matters in terms of them having to suffer through cross-examination. It matters when the trial judge, who I believe is already a gatekeeper, determines under directed verdict if there is any evidence. And there is some suggestion that perhaps we'll, to answer Justice Corning's last question to Mr. Hill, there's been some talk about Rule 403, and the judge is a gatekeeper under 403 getting to listen to the evidence and determine the proper value versus the prejudicial effect. I believe that to pre-labeled categories that every case in Texas has to meet, regardless of whether it's a convicting case, regardless of whether it's a suppressed memory case, or whatever it is, to have pre-labeled categories that we have to try to come under offers trial lawyers and judges, I think, no guidance at all. A suggestion, if the court is considering one, is maybe Rule 401. There's been some articles written that what could occur, and I know that there is a lot of courts that are honestly wrestling with this, not from the plaintiff side and the defendant side, but just courts that are trying to figure out what to do with toxic court cases. The suggestion is under 702, refer to Rule 403 and have the burden on the proponent to show generally that we meet 403. It gives the judge a heightened gatekeeper responsibility. But what it prevents is it prevents categories from being listed. For example, if we go by Justice Gonzalez's opinion in Robinson and we look at those categories, my fear is that you have companies, perhaps, who say, do not look at whether a drug causes a birth defect. Be sure you look at these categories and be sure you have evidence or you have something that will support us if we are sued. The categories don't work for the public. They don't work for the defendants. Either. They don't work for the plaintiffs.
You mentioned a lot of courts are wrestling with this. According to the petitioners of more than 2,000 Bendectin suits that have been brought, only one so far has resulted in a final verdict upheld on appeal for the plaintiff, and that was nearly 10 years ago in the District of Columbia. Is that correct?
Well, there was the multi-district litigation in Cincinnati that dismissed carte blanche, a ton of kids. I don't know the number. I know that there is one still.
One in Pennsylvania that's still before the appellate court.
Yeah, and Mr. Nace has one from the D.C. Circuit State Court that is still alive.
Now, if that's a correct legal landscape, it seems to me this judgment can be upheld for one of only three reasons. Either the great weight of law, either all these cases are wrong, the other appellate cases we're looking at, mainly from the federal circuit, or there's something different in the proof of this case at the trial. The quality of the proof is different, so that this case would come out differently in those other courts as well as in this one. Or third, there's something different about Texas law, where we would apply a different standard than most of the courts around the nation have applied. Now, which one or more of those three categories should this case fall into to support an affirmance?
Door number two.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill, in answer to Justice Owen's question, you agreed that association is not the same as causation?
Yes, sir, I do agree.
Does that agreement mean that Dr. Glasser's testimony doesn't rise to the level of testimony showing causation and therefore is no evidence.
If you look at it by itself, there's never been any debate that all you can do is show whether there is an association.
Well, do you agree that causation is the level that the testimony must reach before it's admissible to the jury?
Yes, sir.
And so if it only rises to the level of association, it is no evidence. Is that the conclusion?
It's a fair conclusion.
And that's all that the Court of Appeals said, that Dr. Glasser testified, that there is an association between benedictine and limb reduction defects if it occurs within the first trimester. That is not evidence of causation, would you agree?
I believe that that gets us towards the level that we need to be. I believe that when we consider it in light of Dr. Newman's testimony, who says...
No, we're just talking about Dr. Glasser.
Glasser by himself does not get us.
Okay. Thank you.
And you say that the evidence is qualitatively different in this case. And you just said that's more than Dr. Glasser's testimony.
Yes, sir.
You get Glasser, Newman, who else gave different, higher quantum of testimony in this trial than in any of the other cases they testified in?
Glasser, Newman, Adrian Gross, from the FDA, Dr. Palmer, and again, the evidence in Daubert is not the same as the evidence here. Daubert went up on summary judgment based on affidavits. We have 40 volumes. We were a month in trial. Our record is as replete as
without waiting. What is different about Palmer's testimony
than
this
one?
Very
different. Is my green light being
there? You should have sat down, but since you're only responding to questions, we'll give co-counsel his full allotted time to argue.
And with Justice Owen's permission, Mr. Mason, I spent last night talking about this, and if I could defer to him on that particular question.
Any other questions for Mr. Hilliard?
I have a question. That is that at a minimum, should this case not be reversed and remanded because the trial court applied a wrong standard with regard to the admissibility of the evidence, and the Court of Appeals applied a wrong legal standard with regard to the burden of proof?
The trial court, standard the trial court applied was pre-Daubert and pre-Ross. It had no guidance that way, but if you read the record, you will find that the argument of Merrill Dow's lawyer mimics Daubert. It was the same trawlers. Remanding could cure the problem. I do not concede, especially on the one point of the trial judge, that he did not spend a lot of time trying to listen to whether or not these experts met 702 or 702.
What about the Court of Appeals conclusion that, the en banc conclusion that since the defendants did not satisfy their burden of proving that the expert should be excluded, that they're going to uphold the case, when in reality it seems to me that the burden is upon the party offering the experts.
Right. Even though at the time, I don't know that that was our burden, when you go back and read the record, you will find that we offered specific evidence that is consistent with Robinson on the methodology. And in the record, there is no evidence from Merrill Dow that the methodology is wrong. There is not one iota of evidence that lets Judge Westergren know that maybe there is another methodology I should look at. All they had was the lawyer standing up and saying, Judge, this just isn't right. But he couldn't look at anything in the record and say, well, then it is right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Court. Let me additionally say that we have to understand that the issue is not what the conclusions are of the expert witnesses. I think this court is out, and Albert court is out, and we don't look at the conclusions, we look at the methodology. The methodology in this case has never been contested in this case. And the methodology, according to the experts, as to how one arrives at a conclusion, is set forth in our brief. In our brief, we pointed out an article in Teratology magazine, and I should also note that this is a case of teratology, not epidemiology. Teratology is what we're talking about.
And in the magazine in 1990, it indicated that there is a, what it is, they interviewed people who looked at the issue of what causes, what is a developmental toxicant. And a developmental toxicant is a drag. So how do you decide what a developmental toxicant is? And in there, they said, after talking to
me, did you say that somewhere it says that a developmental toxicant is a shredded?
Absolutely.
Where did you say that?
You can find that in any dictionary. A developmental toxicant is something that interferes with the development of the growth of the cells and the fetuses. That is what developmental biology, that's what we're talking about here. And teratology is something that the study of what goes wrong.
Does that mean that when the FDA said that this drug was a developmental toxicant, they were saying that it was a teratogen?
They were absolutely saying it has the ability to interfere with the development of the cells in utero, the fetus. Absolutely.
If that's the case, then why did the FDA not ban the drug?
Well, this happened in 1987. There's been no discussion since 1980. In 1980, what the FDA did was they looked at it and they required several warnings. And then the drug was taken off the market. There's been nobody that's looked at it since 1983, to examine all of this data. It's not there. Why would anybody examine it at this point? It's not being used. The FDA has plenty of other things to do. But if you look at what Teratology Magazine says, it says that you look at all of these elements, you look at the humans, you look at the animals, you look at the in vitro, you look at the pharmacological data, you look at all of these things. And that's not too unique, because in this case, the question was also asked, of one of the witnesses testifying for the plaintiff, on page 1831, Dr. Swan was asked about a particular article, and the article was read to her. And the question, and the article says, it's the Unruhsen article, says, quote, "And since such a decision should be based on all available information, in vitro data, animal teratogenicity study testing, studies not included in the present analysis, of which a meta-analysis may only represent a relatively minor portion." All the articles tell us, we look at everything. We don't just look at epidemiology. Your Honor asked about...
What's different about your methodology in this case and all the other cases?
What's different? There's nothing different about the methodology.
The methodology
other than it's been explained. And, for example, Dr. Palmer spent probably 100 pages talking about what is done here. Each of the experts, Dr. Glasser in epidemiology, explained what this all means, what it's all about. And yes, there is a study. And to talk about reanalysis, there couldn't be a better example than what we have in this case. In this case,
if the methodology is the same in this case as in Daubert, for example, why shouldn't the result be the same?
Because nobody ever got into what all this means, what all the methodology means, and how
it's done. Circuit did.
That's maybe an issue. Not referred to in Daubert, if you look at it, in the opinion.
I have looked at it.
And I mean, it doesn't refer to it on the various issue methodology. It doesn't talk about what you should use. But I can assure you that's what it is. But as far as reanalysis, now, if somebody asked about reanalysis here, the FDA, and this is in the brief or in the transcript of page 792, an exhibit. Dr. Franz Rosa at the FDA took one of the studies. He looked at the data in the studies. And he found that there was a 2.13 relative risk when he looked at the right period of time. Now, is this a reanalysis? Is this something wrong? Something bad? Of course not. This is what you're supposed to do. You look at the raw data and say, what does this mean? The FDA did it. And this is what they came up with. So, yes, there is a showing of a doubling when it wasn't in any of the other cases. And in addition, the limb defects studies in this case that we presented were all in excess, a relative risk in excess of 1, 1.18 in Cordero, 1.10 in McCready, 4.39 in Eskenazi.
Was it Dr. Glasser that testified?
Yes.
But he still did not say that in reasonable medical probability that this caused the birth.
And he cannot, and that's the whole point. He cannot.
Why can't he?
Because he is testifying about epidemiology studies. And epidemiology studies, none of these studies that we've heard about, will say or can say Bendectin causes. Because all epidemiology studies can do is say, there is or is not an association.
So the fact that the risk factor is 2.13 is still not evidence of causation.
By itself? No. No, absolutely
not. What is different about Dr. Palmer's testimony in this case and all the other cases? Is there any difference, and if so, please be very specific in telling us what it is?
That point right there, what I just, we just talked about, wasn't in the prior cases.
I'm talking about Dr. Palmer's testimony.
Dr. Palmer based his opinion on the epidemiology, of including the 2.13, including the 4.39. He based it on that, where that wasn't done before. There was even an article that came out called Shiono, S-H-I-O-N-O, which showed limb reduction defects increased over 2, which wasn't even available at the time of the Dauber case. Came out sometime after that.
Would you state that reference again?
Shiono, S-H-I-O-N-O.
And what is that?
That's another article. We all know these articles by first names or last names. This is an article that appeared that indicated that, that the relative risk with limb reduction defects in Bendectin was over, I think it was 2.39, it's in our brief, 2.3.
And that's a peer-reviewed article?
Yes, it is.
Where was it published? If you don't have it fingertips,
don't
worry
about it. I don't have it in front of it. Sometime in the late 80s, I think around 87, 88.
No, where was it published?
Where?
In what publication, if you recall? That's all right.
I'm sorry. I don't know. I remember where it was. And as far as the issue on peer review, there is a brief that we filed, an amicus brief that we brought in here to show on peer review. This peer review is not all it's cracked up to be, Your Honor. For example, the peer review amicus indicated that when they peer review something, they may spend as much as 2.4 hours reviewing the entire article. That's the average amount of time. So it's not as if this is a great scientific arbiter, because something has been peer reviewed. How good are those articles? For example, a lot of these articles, we say the credibility is zero because they were paid for by the defendants, or had to, they had something to do with it, or they had the experts on the on a chair situation. They were paying for a chair, as in the Smithel situation. So we should be entitled to cross-examine and learn what those articles are all about. How good are those articles? And that's what we did. And that hasn't been done, I don't think, to this extent before. Now, there are, what we're saying, what you have to find, in order, I would say to find against Kelly Hadley, you would have to find that unless there is peer-reviewed epidemiological data, that the child cannot win a case, even though at no time was thalidomide found to be a teratogen. In the entire history of man, one drug has found to be a teratogen, one, through epidemiological studies. And that was relatively recently. And yet we know there are a lot of teratogens out there. But that's what you have to find. You have to make a scientific determination, because in the four corners of this record, there is nothing more that can be done. We followed every proper methodological step in putting this evidence on. It was, even the defendants did not disagree with the methodological process that was used.
Let me ask you this. In applying the DuPont versus Robinson standard, and comparing this case to the thalidomide cases, weren't there statements from the scientific community saying that there was a causal link between thalidomide and injury?
Well, that was such a dramatic one, Your Honor. Eventually, there were some studies done in West Germany that showed that 9 months after somebody took thalidomide, when they were pregnant, a child was born with a defect. That's a bad, bad example, in all honesty.
But getting back to the crux of the point here, though, there still have been no statements made to or in the scientific community, no statements made outside of the litigation context, which say that this drug causes birth defects.
But there are studies that show that it interferes with cell development, in vitro studies. There are pharmacological studies that show something else, that it causes problems. There are epidemiological studies that show increased risk. There are animal studies that show that there are limb defects created with animals. Now, should somebody bring that all together, Your Honor? I represent Kelly Haver. Should somebody get in there and put all that together and send it in? Well, it's not really of any value anymore because the drug's off the market, for one thing. The only people that are going to publish it are those who have a connection with the company. We've seen that happen.
Are the animal studies discredited by the fact that the doses that were given to the animals in the testing were grossly excessive and compared to what a human would be taking?
Absolutely not, because the testimony in this case and in the articles is that you give a lot. You're not dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of animals. You're dealing with small numbers of animals. The standard practice as described in this record, is to give large amounts of it to stress the animals and see what happens on it. You take that, and do you just say, aha, that tells me that therefore it causes an injury in a young child? No. But is it one of the pieces of the puzzle? Yes. Do you consider that in light of the human data? Yes. Do you consider that in light of all these other things? Yes. And that's what was done
here. But of all your experts that you put on that looked at all of this evidence, only one was willing to make the causation link. Is that correct?
No, that's not true, Your Honor. Only one made the causation link. This idea that only one was willing to do it, am I supposed to bring in two, three, or four, or five experts?
None of them did. None of the others did.
Well, there's a reason for that. There's a reason. You would not expect the animal pathologist to make that connection in a human being. You would not expect an epidemiologist to make a connection in a human being. You would not expect a pharmacologist to make a connection in a human being. You would not expect the in vitro expert, the developmental biologist, to make that connection. You would expect a doctor to make that connection. That's why there is only, quote, only one who made that statement.
Let me ask you, you say that we're, under DeBert, we're only, Daubert, we're only interested in methodology and not conclusions.
Yes, sir.
But in truth, can any doctor in this country or anywhere else state scientifically causation, state a causation element here in this case simply because an epidemiological study showed a relative risk factor of 2?
No. That's why you put it all together. And you have to put the timing in there, too.
That's, but my point is, can any doctor in this country establish causation, make an expert determination of causation simply based on a study that showed a relative risk factor of 2?
I keep saying, no, I agree with you, no, but that's
so
not that's begging the point.
So Dr. Palmer here states causation.
Yes.
I understand the difference in the evidence is that one who has studied a previous report says there's a relative risk factor exceeding 2. How can, if the doctor can't state that based on simply a relative risk factor of 2, then how can we say, well, this doesn't do it, but if we look over here and add that in, it does do it?
Because the methodology that's appropriate to make these determinations is not to look just at a study that has a relative risk of 2. The appropriate way to do it is to look at that study and all of these other things and put them all together. That's what any doctor can then express an opinion within a reasonable degree of certainty, more likely than not would probably happen here, putting them all together. Can someone make a statement 100% certain? Of course not. 95% certain? Of course not. But we don't deal in life with 100% certainty or in the court of law. We deal with what more likely than not happened. This is not a scientific laboratory. This is a place where we decide, we dispense
there
justice.
There is no scientist that will say this is more likely than not by reasonable medical probability based on a relative risk factor too.
Not just that alone. And
I guess I'm having difficulty. What courts have to wrestle with is in an associational case, they have to decide when you can't establish causation, will we permit recovery in cases where a relative risk factor of some figure is reached?
To wrestle with that, if you accept that argument then, Your Honor, every time we have a study of over two, whatever the drug happens to be, without any question, that drug caused a defect in a particular child. That's the converse of what you're saying. That's not right either. That's why you have to look at more than just one result. You have to look at all of the data. I'm really trying to answer what you're saying to me, but Your Honor, I believe that if you're saying just that one study, that's not the way it's done.
Are there any other questions?
Are you saying that a relative risk factor in excess of 2 will permit an inference by an expert witness or a testimony as to a conclusion of causation?
I think that the article that we cited, the evidence in this case, is that a relative risk in excess of 1 permits an inference with other data. How good is that inference? It's subject to cross-examination. But it would permit that inference. And in this case, we have, for limb defects, we had 4 in excess of 1. One of those in excess of 1 was 13, 1 was 2, different one, but that would permit an inference with with other material. Now, I would not want to go into court in front of a jury and try to convince a jury that based on one study where there is a relative risk in excess of two, that my client should win.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear a rebuttal argument.
Let me just quickly, as far as Dr. Glasser and the factor of two, that was in a reanalysis, which is the very thing we're criticizing the plaintiff's case about fundamentally, is that all it amounts to is an effort to reanalyze evidence that's against them. So there is no study or report of the kind that you're asking about where it's up to two. As far as his suggestion that it can be,
if I may just stop you there, though, and ask you about reanalysis, your adversaries argued that they employed the identical methodology that Merrill Dow did, but that and you're critical of their evidence because you said it's a reanalysis, but if we don't allow any expert opinion based upon a reanalysis of data produced by a drug manufacturer to the FDA or any other governmental entity, on what basis would any injured party ever be able to introduce evidence that would be different from that produced by a drug manufacturer, because it would all, because nobody would be able to afford to do the epidemiological studies and the sort of analysis that the manufacturer is capable of doing?
Well, you've offered up a lot there. Number one, we don't rely on reanalyzing anything. We rely on what's been done by outside, independent, most of these, had Merrill had nothing to do with, outside, worldwide, human studies, which is absolutely the accepted scientific way of trying to address the questions before this court. And I hope that we can hold on to a jurisprudence myself that will say to lawyers, if you've got one of these novel scientific issues, you may have to wait. I understand there was a lawyer recently that pulled one down and said, well, we will just wait. But you can't just come into the courtroom and start trying to take what others have done that are scientists and trying to reanalyze it and make something different out of it and reach different conclusions about it and have a case. Criticism of what others do is no substitute for proof in a court of law. They still are here without any proof of their own that passes any kind of test. Even if you set Robinson aside, as Judge Sheridan pointed out, it just simply doesn't rise to reliability. It doesn't even under the Kelly doctrine that we had before Robinson. It is a classic case of unreliable scientific evidence. No wonder it's been rejected time after time after time. Now, to say that all these experts, that their methodology has not been challenged, my goodness, how can they stand up in a courtroom and say that? We have challenged this methodology all over the United States. We certainly challenged it here vigorously. This is not that you don't extrapolate animal studies, which also are against them, by some sort of reanalysis to get into human causation. You don't take a fluid and put it in a glass and in a tube and shoot it with 2,400 times the dosage that you give to a mother and say that you can translate that into human causation. You wrote yourself that drug experience reports in Eli versus Lilly are not ever to be used for causation. That's not their purpose. So what you've got here is just an effort to take evidence that's overwhelmingly against the proposition that Bendectin causes limb reduction defects, and allowing lawyers, not in the science, not in the laboratory, not in the field, I don't know how expensive it would be, but can you really believe that Dr. Palmer would publish in some scientific journal what he has said and what he's trying to parlay as a basis for human causation? It would be laughable. It is not a scientific approach to the issue. Yes, ma'am.
At what point does associated with become causation?
Association alone never makes it.
That's been ruled in this litigation and many other litigations. As Judge Baker says, you can say, well, I think, in the first place, there's no proof here that there's an association even between Bendactin and limb reduction defects. There were two or three tests that marginally said that it might be associated with one was a possible cardiac defect, which they weren't able to replicate. One had to do with the cleft they were not able to replicate. All it was just a speculative kind of conclusion about association. Suspicion, speculation is all they have in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.